From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
When I think of hospitals that were turned into war zones, of mutilated corpses scattered on the streets of Baghdad and other Iraqi cities, of hundreds of thousands of children who died because of sanctions, I'm reminded of Howard Zinn's words, "There is no flag large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people."
Today, Kathy Kelly, founder of Voices in the Wilderness. She's been in Iraq for months. Nearly 60 people have died in Kirkuk in the past week, not from continuing violence, but from landmines. We'll go to northern Iraq, where hundreds of international workers are trying to demine the area. And we'll look at the U.S. military's use of dolphins, chickens, sea lions, dogs, and pigeons. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of thousands of Shiite Muslims have converged on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala. They're demanding that U.S. troops get out of Iraq. The numbers could surpass 1 million this week as the pilgrimage reaches its climax. According to a front page report in today's Washington Post, Bush administration officials say they underestimated the organizational strength of the Shiites. They're concerned they could establish a fundamentalist Islamic anti-American government in Iraq and are unprepared to prevent it. A meeting of generals and admirals at the Pentagon on Monday turned into a spontaneous teach-in on Iraq Shiites and the U.S. strategy for containing Islamic fundamentalism in Iraq. One of the main strategic goals of the U.S. since the Iranian Revolution in 1979 has been to contain radical Shiite fundamentalism. In the 80s, the U.S. backed Saddam Hussein as a bulwark against Iran, but now the U.S. has toppled Saddam's government. U.S. officials told the Washington Post that as the administration plotted to overthrow the Iraqi government, too little attention was paid to the dynamics of religion and the politics in the region. This comes as U.S. officials told the New York Times that Iranian-trained agents have crossed into southern Iraq since the fall of Saddam Hussein and are working in the cities of Najaf, Karbala, and Basra to promote friendly Shiite clerics and advance Iranian interests. Meanwhile, U.S. troops detained and later released a senior Shiite Muslim cleric, Ayatollah Mohammad Taqi Mudaresi, leader of an Iraqi exile group, after he crossed the border from Iran to attend the pilgrimage in Karbala. And in Baghdad, hundreds of Shiites yesterday staged demonstrations outside the Palestine Hotel for the second straight day. They demanded the release of Baghdad's leading Shiite cleric, Sheikh Mohammed al-Fartusi, who they said had been arrested by U.S. forces. One of al-Fartusi's students who organized the protests told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "Saddam was talking about freedom while killing us. The Americans are also talking about freedom, but they're beginning to behave like Saddam." Within hours, it was reported that the cleric had been released from custody, although U.S. officials never confirmed he was initially detained. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal reports hundreds of flourishing gun fairs have sprung up around Iraq since the fall of Saddam. Under Saddam, Iraqis needed to go through strict background checks by the secret police before they could obtain a gun license. Now anyone who has money can buy a gun. At one market in a Shiite area of Baghdad, an oil company worker told the Wall Street Journal people are buying weapons to kill U.S. soldiers if they don't leave Iraq. In the north, the Independent of London reports Americans are accused of turning a blind eye to killings and even ethnic cleansing. Organizations representing the Turkoman population say the U.S. is failing to protect them from the Kurds, who were victims of oppression under Saddam Hussein. In Kirkuk, the city near the richest oil wells in the country, around a dozen people are reported to have been killed. Dozens of families, mainly Turkoman, but some of them Arab, are said to have been driven from their homes by Kurds. This comes as the New York Times published on its front page a picture of new Iraq ruler General Jay Garner receiving a, quote, rapturous welcome in northern Iraq from the Kurds. The New York Times reports Garner worked the crowds like a gleeful political candidate. Thousands of U.S. soldiers poured into central Mosul in tanks and armed trucks yesterday. The show of force was aimed at ending resistance to U.S. troops, as well as intimidating heavily armed rival factions and taking control of the divided Iraqi city. Marines have had a series of gunfights with locals in the past several days. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix said yesterday the U.S. case for an invasion of Iraq was built on false intelligence reports. Referring to false documents purporting to show that Iraq had imported tons of uranium, he told the BBC it's disturbing that U.S. and British intelligence agencies did not discover that the documents were falsified and asked who falsified them. Blix also accused U.S. officials of deliberately seeking to discredit his team in the run-up to the war in a bid to win political support for the invasion. In a briefing to the U.N. Security Council, Blix said that without U.N. verification, U.S. post-invasion inspections lack credibility. U.S. Secretary of State General Colin Powell told the Charlie Rose TV show yesterday that France will suffer consequences for opposing the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Powell said the U.S. has to review its relationship with France, but would not say what the consequences might be. News of his comments comes after the French ambassador to the U.N. unexpectedly proposed the immediate suspension of U.N. sanctions against Iraq. But Ambassador Jean-Marc de la Sablière also said that the lifting of sanctions was, quote, linked to the certification of the disarmament of Iraq. He said the Security Council should look for ways to combine the work of UN and U.S. inspectors so that the Iraqi disarmament can be internationally verified. Russia and Germany are also saying that UN inspectors should be allowed to join the U.S. weapons hunt. Paul McCartney has called for a ban on cluster bombs. The former Beatle told the BBC that after the fighting is finished, it's civilians, mainly women and children, who are blown up. The interview will be broadcast on Monday to coincide with the release of a new album featuring Paul McCartney, David Bowie, Cat Stevens, and other artists. Profits will go towards charities aiding children in Iraq. The U.S. weapons manufacturer Lockheed Martin announced a jump in first quarter profits and raised its forecast for the coming year. Sales at the company's aeronautics division more than doubled. Lockheed makes the F-16 and F-22 fighter jets used in the invasion of Iraq, and Raytheon revealed a jump in sales at the unit which manufactures the Tomahawk cruise missile. Meanwhile, the New York Post is reporting four U.S. soldiers have been arrested for trying to make a profit on the war. They attempted to take nearly $1 million U.S. dollars from the huge stash found hidden on the grounds of several estates in Baghdad. The four men face court martials. Talks between the U.S., North Korea, and China began today in Beijing. They are the first negotiations since North Korea announced it was resuming its nuclear program last October. The city of Beijing has closed all its primary and secondary schools for at least 2 weeks. An announcement in this morning's papers told the 1.7 million students to study at home. Hundreds of travelers wearing white masks are thronging Beijing's railway stations, desperate to flee the Chinese capital. The panic comes as the government has finally allowed state media to fully report on the disease, this according to Reuters. On Monday, China's top official in charge of Beijing released a statement taking responsibility for providing late and inaccurate data on the epidemic. The Financial Times called the statement an act of contrition not seen since the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre. Liu Qi's statement came a day after the mayor of Beijing and China's health minister were sacked. China acknowledged over 150 more infections yesterday, and Hong Kong authorities announced five more deaths. Meanwhile, China's top genomics institute discovered that the virus is rapidly mutating. Hong Kong has announced a $1.5 billion package to help businesses reeling from the impact. In Singapore, the government threatened to jail people who are violating the quarantine. A team from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control has arrived in Canada after Canadian healthcare workers in two Toronto hospitals were exposed to the virus despite taking all recommended precautions, including wearing goggles, gowns, and a double set of gloves. About 7,000 people have been quarantined in Canada, where 14 people have already died from the virus. Israel Radio is reporting that British Prime Minister Tony Blair warned Yasser Arafat by phone on Tuesday that the international community would halt its efforts to bring the Palestinian-Israeli conflict to an end if Abu Mazen isn't confirmed as prime minister. Arafat and Abu Mazen have been unable to reach an agreement on the makeup of the new Palestinian cabinet and have not spoken since Sunday. Haaretz reports that Abu Mazen has prepared a letter of resignation but has not yet delivered it to Arafat. Meanwhile, the LA Times reports that neoconservatives led by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich have launched a campaign to undermine the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace and criticize the State Department. Speaking before the American Enterprise Institute, Gingrich urged the president to, quote, take on transforming the State Department as its next urgent mission. Senator Rick Santorum, the Republican of Pennsylvania, is ignoring calls that he apologize and resign from his Senate leadership post for comments he made comparing homosexuality to bigamy, polygamy, incest, and adultery. Santorum's remarks came as he talked about the Supreme Court reviewing the sodomy laws in Texas. He told the Associated Press, quote, if the Supreme Court says that you have the right to consensual gay sex within your home, then you have the right to bigamy, you have the right to polygamy, you have the right to incest, you have the right to adultery, you have the right to anything. The U.S. government was sued Tuesday for maintaining a secretive no-fly list. The ACLU is joining the suit on behalf of two women who publish War Times, a newspaper critical of the invasion of Iraq. Rebecca Gordon and Jay Adams were stopped at San Francisco's airport last August and held for 20 minutes by police before they were allowed to board. There have been many similar reports of journalists being detained at airports when entering and leaving the country and then being told their names were on a list. A spokesperson for the FBI in San Francisco said the no-fly list came into existence after the September 11th attacks and was an effort to gather information about the hijackers. The suit against the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Transportation Security Administration seeks access to records on no-fly lists and the payment of legal fees. After the U.S. government was sued, administration officials said they'll review the policy.
از بر رفیقان وطن دل بیقراره ای دست و بهاره.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we go directly to Amman, where Kathy Kelly is standing by, founder of Voices in the Wilderness. She has just come out of Iraq, has been there for how long, Kathy?
Well, I first traveled over in October, Amy. I took a couple of weeks back in the States in late December, but I was in Iraq from January through to a couple of days ago.
So you've been there for around 8 months. We haven't spoken to you since the invasion began, since the phone lines went down, since you didn't have a satellite phone. Can you simply start by describing what it was like during the bombing?
Well, Amy, I suppose what I'm most reminded of are the children that were in the hotel that we shared with several families. And in a way, they were very, very courageous. But if you can imagine a three-year-old and a one-and-a-half-year-old, as the night wore on, and day and night there were huge explosions, they started to grit their teeth. And one little girl, Milad, her only way of coping was to constantly enact in her play an airplane hitting her and she would fall over dead. Or she'd take a flashlight when it was pitch black because we didn't have any electricity and pretend to shoot her mother or shoot me. And this was how she coped. And the floors would shudder, the windows would shake, and we began to realize that there really was no place that was safe. Maybe some of your listeners read about a birthday party that we went outside and held on the riverbank. And it was our way of saying normalcy in defiance of what has to be utterly abnormal, this war. And we never, never, never would have placed the children we knew in greater danger. But there was no place that was safe. So we had barbecued chicken and Pepsis and party favors and held a birthday party under skies that were filled with black clouds because oil fires had been set all around the city to try to create greater density that might have perhaps made it a bit safer from a laser-propelled weapons. I suppose the pent-up anxiety and fear then gave way to a concern about looters and thieves that were roaming around through the city immediately after the government fell. And in fact, we had word that they were at the bridge, which was maybe about a 10-minute walk away from where we were. And we, in this off in our hotel, began to think, maybe we're going to be the cause of this hotel being looted, because we were the only Westerners there, Iraq Peace Team members, and people would presume that we had some funding. And so we were then quite nervous. We didn't want to see the hotel windows smashed. We didn't want to see anybody trying to protect us with guns. And then we heard the huge roar of APCs and tanks and Humvees, and the U.S. military came in to occupy the exact intersection where we stayed. And from that time on, we certainly got a taste of occupation. There was no freedom of movement. And in fact, when I left, we were specifically banned from going over to the place where media people are mainly dwelling, in the Palestine Hotel, because we'd issued a press release that I think in a very understated way listed the ongoing suffering and death-dealing consequences that were happening, because this occupation came with no plan, with no means to do the minimal to try to preserve life and human rights in Baghdad. And so that's sort of a thumbnail sketch, I suppose. I could also mention that driving out of the city, when I and Kathy Breen and a few others left, we came to a neighborhood on the outskirts called Abu Ghraib, and we'd heard rumors that the corpses of cattle and human beings were strewn in that area, and that there was, this is rumor, but that there was bulldozing going on to bury these corpses. Well, anyway, the stench was just overwhelming. It wasn't the stench of a farming area that's manure. It was a horrible, sick smell. And it was just at that point that the long, long convoy of U.S. military vehicles from the Army, olive-green vehicles with their headlights on like a funeral procession, were coming in to replace the U.S. Marines who'd been the fighting force. And I felt that that was actually a sad and a terrible symbol of what we've seen in this terrible naked aggression that has to be characterized as state terrorism.
We're talking to Kathy Kelly. She has just come out of Iraq. We'll go to break and then come back with her. She is the founder of Voices in the Wilderness. Stay with us.
ذكريات كل اللي فات فاكرة يا بلدي قلبي مليان بحكايات فاكرة يا بلدي أول حب كان في بلدي مش
مصر. You're listening to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report, Breaking the Sound Barrier with Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness, twice nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, has spent the majority of the past year in Iraq, has just come out of the country, is speaking to us from Amman. Let's talk about the latest situation in Baghdad right now. Hundreds of thousands of Shiite Muslims have converged in Karbala. In Baghdad, the hundreds of Shiites staged demonstrations outside the Palestine Hotel for the second straight day. They demanded the release of a Shiite cleric, though the U.S. didn't admit they held him. He was then released. We also have reports of gun fairs springing up all over. Can you talk about what it is like right now and the attitude of the people in Baghdad since Saddam Hussein is no longer in control?
Well, of course, there's a whole marketplace of identities and attitudes, but I can tell you a little bit of what I've heard. One man said to me that Iraqis are beginning to realize that the U.S. occupation will liberate them from the illusion that the United States ever wanted to save Iraq. There is seething resentment over the U.S. decision to protect the oil fields and the oil ministry and not to protect the hospitals and the National Museum and the libraries and the schools. Great grief over the loss of history, of records, of, in a sense, a dignity and a pride that was something that belonged to all of Iraq. People say the buildings didn't belong to Saddam Hussein. They belong to all of us. So there's bewilderment and despair and a great deal of fear. Many people in their neighborhoods are taking turns posting people outside overnight holding Kashalnikovs to guard houses. And these are people who never wanted to pick up guns before. I know one man who paid 2 million Iraqi dinar, 2,000 American, to avoid going into the army. And now he sits out in front of his house at night, and his house had already been hit by U.S. bombs. I think that It's very telling that maybe a few hundred Iraqi people came to the statue of Saddam Hussein to topple it. Now, we knew that neighborhood quite well, and it didn't seem to us that the people who came from the neighborhood. But at any rate, I think we should compare that figure with the over a million people that went to Karbala to commemorate the deaths of Shiite leaders who died, were murdered some 14 centuries ago. I think that's something we should all take into consideration, that the energy behind the Shia sect of Islam, which represents Iran and close to three-fourths of the Muslims in Iraq, is quite high, and that's likely to move in and fill a power void in a vacuum. One has to hope that there won't be great infighting both between the Shias and then between the Shias and other entities such as the Kurds, and yet a smooth transition to democracy seems like a pretty fanciful idea, particularly as it's coming out of the barrels of Anglo-UK American guns. I think that quite a number of people are wishing they could get out now because they are afraid of what the future will bring. And it's also, to me, a very sad irony that some of the people who might identify as very genuine and authentic voices of deep concern for their society, for their civilization, for the next months, who speak English, need, just because of how else can they bring income into their families, to take jobs not serving the interests of somehow developing governance in Iraq, but serving the interests of journalists who need translators. And you see an influx of Western media, an influx of Western NGOs. And it's hard. It's hard for people who've just wanted to preserve a very simple lifestyle, a very simple faith, a very simple culture, to now see the harbingers of Western influence that they don't particularly want for their children, being able to have free rein running all over their city and taking on the responsibility to describe Iraq and rebuild Iraq. I know one builder who said, "Do you think they would ever hire me?" to accomplish these tasks. There's a sense that much of the rebuilding of Iraq will be handed out in contracts to ultimately serve the interests of America and rebuild the American economy.
Kathy, there's a front page story in the Washington Post today, Bush administration officials saying they underestimated the organizational strength of the Shiites. They're concerned they could establish a fundamentalist Islamic anti-American government in Iraq and are unprepared to prevent that.
Well, you know, at the moment, I bless the organization of the mosques, which at a time when it looked like utter chaos could overtake people in a lethal and a very, very frightening way, the mosques were able to, without electricity and over microphones and through distribution of leaflets, get the word to many, many neighborhoods to settle down, to stop the killing, to stop attacking hospitals, to restore a lot of the looted goods, which actually did start to happen. And that was a good thing. Now, I don't know if the Sunni neighborhoods are really trusting the Shia announcement that we are not Sunni, we are not Shia, we are all together. But in a situation where there was a total void of any kind of plan to restore some kind of order, it seems to me that the mosque networks were very, very important. Now, what does this portend for the future if there is an Islamic theocracy? Will there be acceptance and tolerance of the Christians, of the Sunnis, of the Kurds? These could be very, very grave and dangerous realities developing. And yet, you know, it seems to me that the governance of Iraq should be left to the Iraqis to sort out and figure out. If the United States picks out puppet leaders that they could then spit out when they're through using them, if the United States tends to identify with wealthy people who control commercial interests and powerful elites and who have a disproportionate representation in Iraq's population, then I think it will sow the seeds for more material destruction and great resentment. And who will be left holding the bag in the future? A generation of Iraqi youngsters who've been betrayed and badly failed by every entity since they were born.
Were you in Baghdad when Zubaydi, one of Ahmed Chalabi's men, announced that he had been elected mayor?
Well, yes. I mean, people look at pictures on TV of fellows like him, and they say, you know, who is this person? And, you know, to be a traitor in Iraqi society is a very, very grave crime. And it seems to me that almost anyone who takes on the role of governance now in cooperation with U.S. occupation runs a great risk of being labeled a traitor and not, both not listened to and possibly eliminated, assassinated.
Kathy Kelly, you are known for spending much of your time in Iraq in hospitals. What about the hospitals now? In fact, when General Jay Garner, the new ruler of Iraq from the United States, came to Baghdad, apparently he first came to a hospital and addressed the doctors.
Well, I think that the doctors, once again, have been very heroic, as they have been all throughout the years when hundreds and thousands of children lost their lives because doctors couldn't save them because of the economic sanctions. It's a very complicated situation in the hospitals because they've relied on protection, and sometimes the protection has been provided by sheikhs and imams and people with guns. I think there's not a high level of trust, even within the hospitals, between some of the senior doctors and some of the younger ones, because a lot of the senior doctors were appointed by the Ba'ath Party. It seems that there's more control coming in, but what's not coming in are adequate anesthetics, medicines that are needed and perhaps are not being adequately tested, like blood serums and diabetes medicine. And there certainly is remaining a kind of a triage setting in, from what I'm told, most of the hospitals. I had visited the Al-Kindi Hospital just before it was badly looted and saw doctors who'd been working round the clock, who'd been seeing hundreds of patients. They were exhausted. They say this is nothing new to them because they've been going through war after war. And I think you have to characterize the economic sanctions as having been an ongoing war. One doctor said to me, you know, if you ever brought me to the United States, and if you ever had invited me to a dancing party, I could not accept. And I thought that was a telling remark in terms of the sadness that's been inflicted on those who tried to cure people and would have wanted to cure their country.
We're talking to Kathy Kelly, who's just come out of Iraq, out of Baghdad. She has spent a majority of the past year in Iraq and was there through the bombing. We're also joined on the telephone from northern Iraq by Sean Sutton of the Mines Advisory Group. Mines and unexploded munitions have killed 52 people and injured 63 in the Iraqi city of Kirkuk over the past, well, just the last week. The Daily Mirror of London is reporting most of the victims are children. Iraq is being reminded once again that long after the combat fighting ends, the killing continues. Over the past week, the mine clearing charity, Mines Advisory Group, has removed 30 truckloads of explosives. That is 11,000 mines plus 200,000 bombs and missiles. But it's estimated that 10 million mines remain lying in Iraq over the past war-torn decade. Sean Sutton, can you tell us where you are?
I'm presently just on the outskirts of Kirkuk.
Describe the geography in terms of landmines.
Well, there is a widespread problem. We've still yet to find out exactly what areas are contaminated. But we can pretty much gather that wherever there's former military positions, there will be protective minefield belts. And so that's just about all the cities in the sort of the northern area where we're working, that sort of Kifri, Kirkuk, Mosul areas. There is a vast landmine problem. That's unquestionable.
During the bombing, we were doing a number of pieces on, for example, Hilla, where cluster bombs, where the U.S. military had dropped cluster bombs. When those cluster bombs go unexploded, are they, in a sense, landmines also?
Well, they're actually quite different in the sense that landmines are designed to be victim-activated. Cluster bombs, like other unexploded ordnance, are a problem because of their failure to detonate as planned. But they are particularly sensitive, which is why there's sort of such a stigma attached to the weapon. And they have been used widely, especially around Mosul. And our teams are, as we speak, clearing cluster bombs of a variety of kinds.
Can you describe what a landmine looks like, what a cluster bomb looks like? How can people right now know where they're walking and where they are?
The cluster bombs, one of the most common ones is a bright yellow cylindrical container, sort of canister about the size of a sort of packet of biscuits with a small parachute attached. And the problem with those with their bright colors is that they can often be quite attractive to children. You also get smaller, sort of bright, sort of silver-colored ones and sort of larger disc-shaped cluster bombs. Landmines, there's quite a variety. There's sort of bounding fragmentation mines, which are sort of quite larger with a sort of spiked top. And then there's sort of different pressure mines for anti-personnel and the larger ones for anti-tank. But obviously these you don't usually see. They're sort of lie under the ground. But we've got teams going out all over the place that are sort of making people aware of the dangers and certain indications that would suggest that the area might be mined, such as near a military position, dead animals. There's also mine marking signs, which we put up, and also local signs like piles of rocks, painted areas on the edge of the roads, that sort of thing. So it's really critical that the message gets out that some areas are potentially dangerous and people should take necessary precautions. But one of the biggest problems here is the vast amounts of unexploded ordnance that is in stockpiles in all the cities, as certainly all the ones where we're working in the north here. When the Iraqi government troops pulled back from areas, they brought back lots and lots of ordnance and prepared military positions around the outskirts as well as inside the towns and cities. Then when the war was over, the troops left and then left behind these vast amounts of unexploded bombs. And I've been sort of spent the last 15 years in conflict and former conflict zones. I've never seen anything like this. In the last week, we've cleared in Kirkuk alone nearly 500,000 items. And the thing is, children are picking these things up and prizing open certain parts of them, particularly the boosters, and getting gunpowder and cordite and making sort of big flashes for fun and genies. And that's partly why the accident rate here is so high. As you mentioned at the beginning, in Kirkuk alone, in over a five-day period, there were 52 deaths and 63 injuries. And those are largely from children. So, and considering in Kirkuk, about 15 people were killed in the war, it explains that sort of surviving the peace can be a lot more difficult and painful than actually surviving the war.
Sean Sutton is speaking to us from northern Iraq near Kirkuk. He's with the Mines Advisory Group, which is based in Britain. How does what you're seeing in northern Iraq right now, both the landmines and the cluster bombs, the concentration of them, compare to places around the world?
It's very extreme, certainly with the unexploded ordnance scenario. But that is, with the right resources, that's relatively easy to deal with the trained teams. It's a matter of taking all the bombs away and blowing them up. At least you can see them, and through working with the community, find out where they are. But they are literally stockpiled in schools, in sort of open areas in the center of towns, in sort of government buildings, all over the place. Then the next problem is the landmines, which is going to be a much more long-term problem as far as dealing with it and providing the solutions. And really, we have to prioritize the work. We can't clear all the landmines, but we can certainly clear the areas that are most needed by communities as they sort of come back and start to farm their land. But the big deal, as far as this is concerned, is resources being made available to do this crucial work. And at present, they simply aren't.
What companies make landmines? What companies make cluster bombs? What companies make landmines and cluster bombs?
Well, the cluster bombs that are here are dropped by the ones in the north here that I've come across are all U.S. cluster bombs. In the southern areas, I think British forces have also dropped cluster bombs. They're comparatively, compared to landmines, they're much easier to deal with the right training, because you can see them and find them on the surface, and you basically blow them up where you find them. The landmines are made in former Soviet Union countries, China, all over the world, in fact. There's also ones from other former Eastern Bloc countries.
Paul McCartney has called for a ban on cluster bombs. He is releasing a new album with David Bowie, Cat Stevens, and other artists. All the profits will go to aiding charities that help children in Iraq. How significant is that when a celebrity of the stature of McCartney does this?
I think it's significant. I think that the focus should very much be on getting rid of these things and clearing them up. I think that certainly MAG's position on the legal issue of the use of cluster bombs is very much along the lines with the International Red Cross, which is that there should be a moratorium on the use of them, that they should only be used in for particular military targets away from habited areas. It's very difficult to actually ban cluster bombs because they're a very effective weapon, unfortunately. But the problem is that they do fail, but all weapons fail, and all weapons are a problem after war.
Who is stopping the ban of the bombs or moratorium on the bombs?
Well, no one is stopping that. That's actually happened and is going through as far as international law is concerned. I think that forces have tried to sort of minimize their use. Those early days for organizations like us, as far as finding out how much they've been used, So far, I have seen one village that was hit that was a frontline position, and the people returned home to find cluster bombs littering their gardens and their houses partly destroyed. But it had been a military position. Most of the other areas, in fact, all the other areas are in quite remote parts where there's military positions. I wouldn't advocate their use, but I think that legally it would be a very difficult thing to do to ban cluster bombs, as opposed to landmines, which are fundamentally different in that landmines are designed to be activated by their victim. Cluster bombs are not designed to be that, to do that. So I would also, if you're going to ban cluster bombs, I'd also ban all the other weapons that are causing all the problems here. Most of the problems here are being caused by unexploded rockets, grenades, mortars, and tank shells. Cluster bombs are certainly a problem, but they're a small part of the overall problem.
We are talking to Sean Sutton of the Mines Advisory Group. He's in northern Iraq. Kathy Kelly on the line with us. She's just come out of Iraq, and she's in Amman, Jordan. Kathy, as you listen to Sean's description, do you have final thoughts as you come out of Iraq now after 7-8 months there?
Well, again, I want to stress that a generation of Iraqi children has been betrayed and failed by very powerful elites all around the world. And I know that the peace movement, the anti-war movement, came close to approaching the critical mass that so many of us have dreamed of, have envisioned as a way to stop and to deter the buildup, the use, the storage of weapons. And so I hope that Sean's vision that the not only the cluster bombs, but the rockets, the mortars, the tanks, all of the ways that people think change can be accomplished through resorting to force rather than resorting to diplomacy and negotiation and peacemaking. I hope that that dream and that vision won't also be a casualty of this war. It's my hope that the anti-war movement will regroup and recommit. And, you know, David Dellinger once said, quoting a friend, that if what you propose will take 1,000 years to accomplish, that's all the more reason to begin this afternoon.
Kathy, you have spent much of the last, years since the Gulf War, decade, going back and forth to Iraq, challenging the UN, U.S. sanctions. You stayed there through the bombing. What are your plans now?
Well, we certainly won't walk away from an effort to continue to be voices on behalf of Iraqi people. Ramzi Kaisia and Cynthia Banas are in Iraq right now to be joined by 3 team members who will come in through Amman tonight. And yet I think in the United States, we in the Voices Network want very, very much to commit ourselves also within the United States to confronting the war machine and to finding ways to do that that have to do with our everyday lifestyles. You know, as long as we think that our overconsumptive and wasteful lifestyles should be protected by a murderous means of war making, then I think we won't be able to approach establishing the conditions that would allow for justice and peace. So we have a lot of thinking to do, a lot of education and outreach. Certainly we need to continue to develop a focus always in parallel with concerns of average and ordinary Iraqis. But we're looking to that anti-war movement to remain galvanized.
And to those who say, but Saddam Hussein has been toppled, a man who has killed thousands of his own people, your response?
Yes, he was toppled, but we cannot let history become eclipsed. He was put in place through powerful forces that included U.S. interests. He was maintained through the arduous years of oppression and ruthless mob kind of activity. He was maintained, I believe, because the United States wanted him just where he was, crippled externally and strengthened internally. And I think that we have to hold up the mirror and look at ourselves in that mirror as being people who had no problem accepting the deaths of hundreds of thousands of children. Any time that we feel dismay and a sense of bewilderment because of the looting and the thieving and the outbreak of mindless destruction that occurred immediately following the U.S. occupation and the crumbling of the regime of Saddam Hussein. I think that that same kind of mindless destruction goes on every day in our society. When you look at the way we treat our planet environmentally, we don't think twice about bringing the planet into ruination. And I think that the same utter lack of concern for innocent human lives characterized U.S. policy all throughout the miserable decade since Saddam Hussein came into power.
Kathy Kelly, thank you very much for being with us, speaking from Amman, just out of Iraq. Look forward to seeing you when you come back to the United States. She is the founder of Voices in the Wilderness. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, the use of animals by the military. Stay with us.
باز آمدم باز آمدم از پیش آن یار آمدم در من نگر در من نگر بهر تو غم خار آمدم شاد آمدم شاد آمدم از جنب آزاد آمدم چند هزاران سال شد تا من به گفتار آمدم تا من به گفتار آمدم
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. War is not healthy for children and other living things. These words were first written by mothers in the United States during the Vietnam War. They were concerned their children were being sent halfway around the world to kill the children of Vietnamese mothers. They put the statement on a postcard and they sent it to Congress. Since then, the words have become a powerful description of wartime destruction of not only people, but also of animals and the environment. In the invasion of Iraq, the Pentagon reportedly has enlisted dolphins, chickens, dogs, sea lions, and pigeons. Plus, there are reports that Morocco gave the U.S. 2,000 monkeys to assist with demining projects. Dolphins are scouting seaports in search of mines. The dolphins are equipped with cameras that transmit video images back to their handlers. When they find a mine, they're trained to report back by playing with a so-called I've found something rubber ball. When the dolphins find a mine, their minder sends a group of human divers to the area to detonate it. The Washington Post reports that Atlantic bottlenose dolphin is the seafaring equivalent of bomb-sniffing dogs. The Marines have been using chickens and pigeons in Kuwait to detect poison gas, but the Marines have admitted that dozens of the birds never made it to the Middle East after dying in transit. The deceased chickens and pigeons will hardly be the first U.S. animals not to return to the States after a war. According to PETA, 5,000 dogs served alongside U.S. troops in Vietnam. Only 140 came home. Some died in Vietnam, but most were abandoned by the military. We're joined right now by William Rivas-Rivas of PETA and David Helvarg. He's the author of Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas. We tried to get someone on from the Navy, but they said they were not available. William Rivas-Rivas, can you describe the extent of the use of animals and your concerns?
Good morning, Amy. We are appalled to hear that the military has essentially drafted these animals that claim no nation, know nothing of Saddam Hussein or Iraq, and sent them to a war that they do not understand. They are using dolphins, as you mentioned, sea lions, pigeons, and chickens to detect chemical weapons and search for mines. We believe that this is completely unethical, that the military should be using technology, the technology that's available, instead of using animals to detect these chemical weapons or search for mines.
David Helvarg, you have looked extensively into this issue. Can you give us a history of the use of dolphins?
Sure, Amy. The program actually goes back to 1960, so the Navy's had marine mammals for 43 years now, not only dolphins and sea lions, but they still have beluga whales. At one point, they had four orcas, killer whales, in their inventory. They're still the largest holder of captive marine mammals in the world. Right now, they've got 75 dolphins, 20 sea lions, two belugas. They, at one point during the Cold War, had over 140. And they said that the deployment of the dolphins here in southern Iraq was the first operational deployment of mine-detecting dolphins, which is technically true, although in Vietnam I've talked to Navy veterans who worked with them in planting limpet mines in Haiphong Harbor on wharfs and jetties there. They're also used for swimmer defense. They've just tested, shown off a couple of sea lions in Bahrain who are trained to attach cuffs to divers' legs, and then that's linked with a line that they get pulled out of the water. They also did dolphin deployments in 87, rather, in during the Iran-Iraq War in the Gulf. They call it a swimmer defense program, and the swimmer defense is also swimmer nullification. They've used them both in non-lethal and lethal ways, although the Navy denies it's classified lethal activity. Swimmer nullifications ranged from killing divers during the Vietnam War using hypodermic needles attached to CO2 cartridges to more recent weaponization of both sea lions and dolphins with a 45 caliber small bang stick attached to their snouts.
You wrote an article in response to the Washington Post piece, David Helvarg, about the use of the K-Dog, the dolphin, in Umkasar.
Sort of a point of view. I'm trying to anthropomorphize a little and take the dolphin's point of view, which is like, hey, dude, it's not our war. I mean, you know, they call it an all-volunteer military, but I don't remember any of these dolphins who got gillnetted out of the Gulf of Mississippi volunteering. Now, of course, they have a breeding program within their system, and right now a couple of the beluga whales are off at SeaWorld breeding, which is certainly a better deployment than chasing after mines in southern Iraq.
Let me ask William Rivas. Rivas, you were in the Navy before you became the campaign coordinator for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA.
I was. After high school, I joined the military and spent about 8 years in the military and was actually sent to the Persian Gulf twice. That's something that David mentioned about the military, that the U.S. military is an all-volunteer force. And it should continue to be an all-volunteer force. And these animals did not volunteer for this war. War is a human endeavor. A person or a political party or a nation can, in fact, choose to go to war. The animals cannot. And David mentioned the inventory that the military has. According to the Navy's own Marine Mammal Inventory report, over 96 dolphins have died in this program for a number of reasons, one of which that I thought was particularly interesting, and the cause of death was failure to adapt, drowning, jaw fractures. I mean, these animals have been suffering before they even reach the Persian Gulf.
Can you talk more about your letter to Rumsfeld?
Excuse me. Yes, we wrote to Donald Rumsfeld, you know, telling him exactly that this war is a human endeavor and that all these animals should be given an honorable discharge and be released and allowed to do natural things, allow them to live their own life and not to go into shark-infested, mine-infested waters in the Persian Gulf and search for mines.
Yeah, it's interesting. At the end of the Cold War, there's a lot of talk of closing the program down. And then the Navy got into littoral warfare, specifically shallow water warfare, as their post-Cold War strategy. in which they got very interested in using the dolphins in mine warfare and ordnance recovery. And so the program continues, even though they now have AUVs, autonomous underwater vehicles, that could do mine detection and other technical means for working. They talk about keeping the animals for the foreseeable future. Recently, when I was out visiting with the dolphins in San Diego when I was working on the book, they'd been testing them for response to low-frequency sonar, and they did find a response, temporary hearing loss, from the use of the Navy's new low-frequency sonar system that's been linked to the deaths of beak whales and other animals in the wild. So it's kind of interesting. The Navy's always promoting its marine mammal as a partnership in the sea. At the same time, it's looking for exemptions under the Marine Mammal Protection Act so that it can kill more cetaceans, dolphins and whales, with the use of this active sonar system. This $350 million program, they say, is to pursue quieter diesel-powered submarines, although, in fact, there are other technical means that could be used, airborne remote sensing, to find those submarines. But, again, the Navy's, claiming that it's great partners with these weaponized animals and at the same time looking for exemptions from the one act that was passed specifically to protect marine mammals.
Would you say that this makes animals targets, David Helvarg?
Absolutely. I mean, during the Cold War, the Soviet Union built an entire counter-dolphin program that included anti-dolphin dolphins, dolphins trained to kill dolphins that came into, U.S. dolphins came into their waters. And clearly with the appearance of mine-hunting dolphins and swimmer defense dolphins, any shallow water environment where there's a hostile nation is going to start killing dolphins and sea lions if they see them, if they expect the U.S. to get involved in these areas. And this is the problem. We're putting the animals in harm's way. And I've covered four wars. I'm unfortunately thinking that we're going to continue having wars as long as we function as the way we do as a species. But, the use of marine mammals to fight our wars, the destruction of their prey sources and habitat in the world's oceans just doesn't reflect well on us as a species.
I want to thank you both for being with us. We've been speaking to William Rivas of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals and David Helvarg, author of Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy of the show, video or audio, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. We're going to go out with Dana Lyons' song, Cows with Guns. Democracy Now is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, so Angie stupid. Karen, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel and Vilka Tsouras. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Die to be it at the hamburger fry. Cows well done. Nobody thunk it. Nobody knew. No one imagined the great cow guru. Cows are one. He hid in the forest, read books with great zeal. He loved Che Guevara, a revolutionary.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Hundreds of thousands of Shiite Muslims have converged on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala. They're demanding U.S. troops get out of Iraq. We'll go to Iraq to speak with an Al Jazeera reporter covering the pilgrimage. We'll hear Columbia University professor Edward Said speak on his classic work, Orientalism and the Invasion of Iraq. And lawyers in Louisiana say DNA evidence proves another man on death row is innocent. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of thousands of Shiite Muslims have converged on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala. They're demanding that U.S. troops get out of Iraq. The numbers could surpass 1 million this week as the pilgrimage reaches its climax. According to a front-page report in today's Washington Post, Bush administration officials say they underestimated the organizational strength of the Shiites. They're concerned the Shiites could establish a fundamentalist, Islamic, anti-American government in Iraq and are unprepared to prevent it. This comes as U.S. officials told the New York Times that Iranian-trained agents have crossed into southern Iraq since the fall of Saddam Hussein and are working in the cities of Najaf, Karbala, and Basra to promote friendly Shiite clerics and advance Iranian interests. Meanwhile, U.S. troops detained and later released a senior Shiite Muslim cleric, Ayatollah Mohammad Taqi Mudarresi, leader of an Iraqi exile group, after he crossed the border from Iran to attend the pilgrimage in Karbala. And in Baghdad, 1,000 Shiites yesterday staged demonstrations outside the Palestine Hotel for the second straight day. They demanded the release of Baghdad's leading Shiite cleric, Sheikh Mohammed al-Fartusi, who they said had been arrested by U.S. forces. More on that in just a few minutes. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal is reporting hundreds of flourishing gun fairs have sprung up around Iraq since the fall of Saddam Hussein. Under him, Iraqis needed to go through strict background checks by the secret police before they could obtain a gun license. Now anyone who has money can buy a gun. At one market in a Shiite area of Baghdad, an oil company worker told the Wall Street Journal people are buying weapons to kill U.S. soldiers if they don't leave Iraq. Meanwhile, in the north, the Independent of London reports Americans are accused of turning a blind eye to killings and even ethnic cleansing. Organizations representing the Turkoman population say the U.S. is failing to protect them from the Kurds who were victims of oppression under Saddam Hussein. In Kirkuk, the city near the richest oil wells in the country, around a dozen people are reported to have been killed. Dozens of families, mainly Turkoman, but some of them Arab, are said to have been driven from their homes by Kurds. This comes as the New York Times published on its front page a picture of the new Iraq ruler, General Jay Garner, receiving a, quote, rapturous welcome in northern Iraq from the Kurds. The Times reports Garner worked the crowds like a gleeful political candidate. Thousands of U.S. soldiers poured into central Mosul in tanks and armed trucks yesterday. The show of force was aimed at ending resistance to U.S. troops, as well as intimidating heavily armed rival factions and taking control of the divided Iraqi city. Marines have had a series of gunfights with local people in the past several days. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix said yesterday the U.S. case for an invasion of Iraq was built on false intelligence reports, referring to false documents purporting to show that Iraq had imported tons of uranium. He told the BBC, "It's disturbing that U.S. and British intelligence agencies did not discover the documents were falsified and asked who falsified them." Blix also accused U.S. officials of deliberately seeking to discredit his team in the run-up to the invasion in a bid to win political support for military action. In a briefing to the U.N. Security Council, Blix said that without U.N. verification, U.S. post-invasion inspections lack credibility. Secretary of State General Colin Powell told the Charlie Rose show yesterday France will suffer consequences for opposing the U.S. invasion of Iraq. He would not say what those consequences will be. News of his comments came after the French ambassador to the United Nations proposed the immediate suspension of U.N. sanctions against Iraq. But Ambassador Jean-Marc de la Sablière also said that the lifting of sanctions are, quote, linked to the certification of the disarmament of Iraq. He said the Security Council should look for ways to combine the work of UN and U.S. inspectors so that the Iraqi disarmament can be internationally verified. Russia and Germany are also saying UN inspectors should be allowed to join the U.S. weapons hunt. U.S. weapons contractor Lockheed Martin yesterday announced a jump in first quarter profits and raised its forecast for the coming year. Sales at the company's aeronautics division more than doubled. Lockheed makes the F-16 and F-22 fighter jets used in the invasion of Iraq. And Raytheon revealed a jump in sales at the unit which manufactures the Tomahawk cruise missile. Meanwhile, the New York Post is reporting four U.S. soldiers have been arrested for trying to make a profit on the war. They attempted to take nearly $1 million U.S. dollars from the huge stash found hidden in the grounds of several estates of Baghdad. The four men face court martials. Talks between the U.S., North Korea, and China began today in Beijing. They are the first negotiations since North Korea announced it's resuming its nuclear program last October. The city of Beijing has closed all its primary and secondary schools for at least 2 weeks. An announcement in this morning's papers told the 1.7 million students to study at home. Hundreds of travelers wearing white masks are thronging Beijing's railway stations, desperate to flee the Chinese capital. The panic comes as the government has finally allowed state media to fully report on the disease, this according to Reuters. On Monday, China's top official in charge of Beijing released a statement taking responsibility for providing late and inaccurate data on the epidemic. The Financial Times called the statement an act of contrition not seen since the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre. Liu Qi's statement came a day after the mayor of Beijing and China's health minister were sacked. China acknowledged over 150 more infections yesterday, and Hong Kong authorities say there have been five more deaths. Meanwhile, China's top genomics institute discovered that the virus is rapidly mutating. Hong Kong has announced a $1.5 billion package to help businesses reeling from the impact. In Singapore, the government threatened to jail people who are violating the quarantine. A team from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control has arrived in Canada after Canadian health workers in two Toronto hospitals were exposed to the virus despite taking all the precautions, including wearing goggles, gowns, and a double set of gloves. About 7,000 people have been quarantined in Canada, where 14 people have already died from the virus. Israel Radio reported that British Prime Minister Tony Blair warned Yasser Arafat by phone Tuesday that the international community will halt its efforts to bring the Palestine-Israeli conflict to an end if Abu Mazen is not confirmed as prime minister. Arafat and Abu Mazen have been unable to reach an agreement on the makeup of the new Palestinian cabinet and have not spoken since Sunday. Haaretz reports Abu Mazen has prepared a letter of resignation, but has not delivered it to Arafat yet. Meanwhile, Los Angeles Times reports that neoconservatives led by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich have launched a campaign to undermine the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace and criticize the State Department. Speaking before the American Enterprise Institute, Gingrich urged the president to, quote, take on transforming the State Department as its next urgent mission. Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania is ignoring calls he apologize and resign from his Senate leadership post for comments he made comparing homosexuality to incest. Santorum's remarks came as he talked about the Supreme Court's review of laws in Texas, which ban consensual sodomy in the privacy of one's home. He told the Associated Press, quote, if the Supreme Court says you have the right to consensual gay sex within your home, then you have the right to bigamy. You have the right to polygamy. You have the right to incest. You have the right to adultery. You have the right to anything. Two women yesterday sued the Justice Department, FBI, and Transportation Security Administration for maintaining a secretive no-fly list. Rebecca Gordon and Jay Adams published the newspaper War Times, which is critical of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. They were stopped at San Francisco's airport last August and held for 20 minutes by police before they were allowed to board. Gordon and Adams were arrested several times in the 1980s for civil disobedience, but did not understand why they would be on a no-fly list today. There have been many similar reports of journalists being detained at airports when entering and leaving the country and then being told their names were on a list. The suit seeks access to records on no-fly lists and the payment of legal fees. The ACLU has joined the suit, and a spokesperson said over 300 people have been stopped and questioned at San Francisco's airport alone. Also yesterday, the Wall Street Journal ran a front-page story which reported that airline reservation systems flag names even if they only resemble a suspect's. U.S. officials say they will review the no-fly list policy now that they've been sued. The judge in the case against Zacharias Moussaoui has ordered the Justice Department to provide Moussaoui's lawyers with any statements by captured leaders of al-Qaeda that could exonerate their defendant. The ruling is a major victory for Moussaoui. Bush administration officials have acknowledged that in recent interrogations, some captured Qaeda members had suggested that Moussaoui was not involved in the September 11th attacks, but was sent to the United States on a different terrorist mission. And this news from the music world. Paul McCartney has called for a ban on cluster bombs. The former Beatle told the BBC that after the fighting is finished, it's civilians, mainly women and children, who are blown up. The interview will be broadcast on Monday to coincide with the release of a new album featuring McCartney, David Bowie, Cat Stevens, and other artists. Profits will go towards charities aiding children in Iraq. And rock star Bruce Springsteen has lashed out against critics of the Dixie Chicks and radio stations, which have banned the group's songs because they criticize President Bush's stance on Iraq. Springsteen yesterday posted a statement on his website reading for the Dixie Chicks to be, quote, banished wholesale from radio stations and even entire radio networks. For speaking out is un-American. The pressure coming from the government and big business to enforce conformity of thought concerning the war and politics goes against everything that this country is about, namely freedom. Right now, we're supposedly fighting to create free speech in Iraq at the same time that some are trying to intimidate and punish people for using that same freedom here at home. Again, the words of Bruce Springsteen. He himself has come under some criticism recently for opening his concerts with a cover of Edwin Starr's anti-war anthem, War. Bruce Springsteen singing Edwin Starr's War here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. In a moment, we're going to be talking about Shiite Muslims, their convergence on the holy city of Karbala, demanding U.S. troops get out of the country. We're going to hear Professor Columbia University Professor Edward Said speaking about Orientalism and the invasion of Iraq. But first, we go down to Louisiana. This is a classic case of wrongful conviction. He was a juvenile, mentally retarded, put on death row for a crime he did not commit. These are the words of Clive Stafford Smith, one of the attorneys for Ryan Matthews, a 23-year-old prisoner on death row. Matthews was 17 when he was arrested for the 1997 murder of Bridge City grocer Tommy Van Hoos. Attorneys for Matthews say DNA tests have proved he's innocent and that another prisoner was the killer. During the trial, experts testified that the DNA evidence did not match Matthews or the getaway driver, Travis Hayes, who's serving a life sentence for the crime. Matthews was largely convicted on the testimony of two eyewitnesses whose testimony has been questioned. Smith said that Matthews fits the legal definition of mentally retarded and cannot be executed because of a decision handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court last year. We're going to go now to a news conference held earlier this week by Clive Stafford Smith, director of the Louisiana Crisis Assistance Center.
The killer wore a ski mask. One of the key witnesses at trial said that he watched the killer come out of the murder scene, drive off, throw the ski mask out of the car. He picked up the ski mask, the witness did, gave it to the police. That ski mask has Rondell Love's DNA on it. Absolutely excludes Ron Matthews. Ron Matthews is innocent. Moments after the murder, one of the state's key eyewitnesses picked up the mask that was worn by the person who committed the murder. We have taken the DNA from the ski mask and we have matched it identically to the DNA from the suspect who we now know as the real killer. It's an absolute match. There is almost no possibility that this person is not the real killer. And I ask you, DNA has been used so many times to send people to death row. What sort of a system is going to refuse to recognize DNA to let an innocent person go? The probability that Ryan Matthews is not the killer is something like 99.99%. And we're absolutely clear of it. There is no jury in the world who would not convict the person who is 99.99% known to be the real killer. There are not enough people in Jefferson Parish for there to be another person who could have committed this crime. I'm not here to prosecute Rondell Love, but I don't think any reasonable person can look at the evidence we've got and say Rondell Love is not the real killer. It's clear he is. It's clear that if he went to a jury in Jefferson Parish, he'd be convicted. What's equally clear is that Ryan Matthews is innocent and Ryan Matthews should not be held on death row.
Clive Stafford Smith, director of the Louisiana Crisis Assistance Center, who held a news conference earlier this week. Among those who spoke was Billy Southern, who's the lawyer for Ryan Matthews. He joins us on the line right now. Billy Southern, Ryan Matthews has been on death row for how long now? Roughly 6 years?
Well, Ryan has been on death row since 1999 when he was sentenced to die. He has been arrested and incarcerated on this charge since 1997, when he was 2 weeks past his 17th birthday.
So why is this evidence just surfacing now?
You know, I think that it's a... I think that we see this pattern in a lot of cases, a lot of death penalty cases. This evidence was available to the DAs at the time of Ryan's trial. The DAs in Jefferson Parish have been in possession of both of these DNA reports since 1998. And I guess it's really unclear whether it was incompetence or whether it was actual misconduct that led to their failure to make the connection between these two DNA reports. It makes no difference to Ryan whether it was incompetence or whether it was active suppression. He's sitting on death row right now because of that suppression. And we're really calling on the Jefferson Parish District Attorney to do the right thing, to consent to a hearing so we can get this evidence in front of the court and so that we can really get Ryan off of death row if the evidence warrants, and we're sure that it will.
Can you talk about the significance, Billy Southern, of James Harrison, who's in prison now? When we come back from our break, we're going to play some exclusive footage of his jailhouse, of his statement in jail about overhearing the jailhouse confession of the man you say is the actual killer. Who is James Harrison?
James Harrison's a man that was incarcerated with Rondell Love, the person who really killed Tommy Van Hoos. Rondell Love confessed to numerous people. He bragged about doing this murder. He really bragged to anyone that would listen. And James Harrison was just another person who was in the Jefferson Parish Correctional Center at that time, and he overheard this guy confessing to the crime. He's trying to do the right thing, so he told us about it, and he took what's really a brave step and gave us a statement because, you know, it's not easy for someone to talk up about these things. And the real significance is that not only do we have the DNA, but we have the DNA corroborated by these confessions, corroborated by other witnesses, corroborated by other things that happened at the time of the crime. So we really feel like we have everything that we need to really prove the truth in this case.
We're going to go to break. When we come back, we're going to play the exclusive footage of James Harrison in jail talking about the jailhouse confession he overheard. We'll also be joined by Peter Neufeld, one of the founders of the Innocence Project, which is joining this case on the issue of DNA, and Pauline Matthews, the mother of Ryan Matthews. Stay with us.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
The late Nina Simone. She died this week at the age of 70 in France. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the case of Ryan Matthews, he's 23. He's on death row in Louisiana for the 1997 murder of a grocer, a crime that his lawyers say that he says he did not commit, and they say they have the DNA evidence to prove it. Let's go right now to James Harrison. He was filmed by Democracy Now!'s Emily Kunstler, who went down to the Louisiana prison. He was talking about the jailhouse confession that he overheard.
My name is James Harrison. We're in WCI, and I'm here for, I got 7 more years to do. When I got arrested, I had went to jail, you know, and they had conversations going on in the holding tank with this guy about this situation, what happened with them, you know what I'm saying? And that's how I know, you know, that they ain't do it. The guy that was talking, his name's Rondell, you know, he wasn't talking to me, he was talking to somebody else in there, you know, but I knew him from just seeing him. You know, he was telling them about what he had done. Something about a man in a store and all that, you know. You know, you're saying, well, that he got another one under his belt. You know what I'm saying? Meaning another one under your belt, meaning, you know what I'm saying, this is another person you didn't kill or somebody like that. You know, and he was also saying about, you know, him and the dude had ski masks on, and, you know, when he shot, they ain't get nothing, he had to run out the store, you know. And that's when he left and went down the river road, you know, and that's where they're supposed to have been to throw the ski masks on side the ditch and a gun in the ditch or something, you know, like that. I know he was talking about the story when he said, you know, this happened in Bread City in a grocery store. That's how I know. Then once I seen, you know, Ryan went to jail on this, about this grocery store, then I know this was it, what they talking about. You know, because the paper, you know, and then everything matched up. When they said, well, Travis Carr fit the description, and Travis Carr's a Grand Prix. And a year the LTD was, and the Grand Prix Travis had, the back lights looked exactly the same. When Travis' car was prime gray, and it was in a gray car. The car that Travis had, no, it shouldn't even fit the description. You know, it's just the back lights look alike. Rondell, nah, he don't care. You know, he felt like, you know, somebody else got the charge. Why should he worry about it? I mean, that's a burden off his back. It make me feel bad, because I feel like if you done something, you should take your charge, you know? Why should you let an innocent person be on that roof for something they ain't do? So, you know, I feel like if he'd have done it, I wouldn't put myself through all this, you know. But I knew he innocent. That's why I put myself through all this, you know what I'm saying? Because I know he's on that rope bad, you know what I'm saying? I feel sorry for him, you know, because, you know, it's a sad situation. You know, you're going through all kind of mental stress behind something you ain't do, you know what I'm saying? And you facing something you don't know if everything gonna work out in your favor, you know, and if things don't work out in your favor, you know you're gonna die, you know? So it's a bad feeling, you know, and I feel bad for him, you know?
James Harrison, he's at the Washington Correctional Institute in Louisiana, talking about the jailhouse confession he overheard of Rondell Love. He said this in a holding tank in the county jail, and says this, along with now DNA tests, indicate that the man accused, who sits on death row, Ryan Matthews, is innocent. We're joined by Ryan Matthews' mother right now. She is Pauline Matthews. How do you feel about this new DNA evidence? What does it mean for your son?
I feel very good about this DNA evidence. It means that my son will finally be free. It means that he has always said he was innocent, and now the DNA proves that he's innocent. And the whole world will know that he is innocent and he told the truth. And finally, I hope that justice will be done. I hope the DA gets this in court as soon as possible and let Ryan free, because every day that Ryan spends in prison is too many days. He has already been in prison for too long, and every day that he's there is too long.
Pauline Matthews, mother of Ryan Matthews. In today's New York Times and the National Report, the headline, this is yesterday's New York Times, Rick Bragg writes, "A skin cell, a little spit, could save Ryan Matthews from Louisiana's death row and shift the blame for his crime to a man across the prison yard." Peter Neufeld is also with us, a lawyer, one of the founders of the Innocence Project, which is a nonprofit legal clinic at Benjamin Cardozo School of Law in New York City. Innocence Project deals with DNA and freeing people based on the evidence. Even with this, Peter Neufeld, what do you think are the chances of Ryan Matthews being freed? And how significant is this DNA test that has been taken?
I think the chances are extraordinarily good that he will be freed now. The problem that Billy and Clive and, of course, Mrs. Matthews, so worried about her son, are confronting down there in Jefferson Parish is another district attorney with tunnel vision who has his sights set on young Ryan and finds it very difficult to let go of that. And so he will, at least for the time being, try and imagine, create, fictitiously any possible theory he can come up with to include Ryan in the case. All of that will evaporate pretty quickly when people realize from the eyewitness testimony, you know, that there was one perpetrator who went in there, wore this particular ski mask, and the DNA on the ski mask comes back to this other guy who's a killer, and clears Ryan completely. So we've seen this before, this kind of reluctance. But eventually, you know, truth will triumph here, and thank goodness for Ryan that it will. From our point of view, Amy, the bigger question is, we now know that Ryan's innocent, but where did the criminal justice system in Louisiana go wrong that allowed this innocent young man to be wrongly convicted and sentenced to death row? That's the bigger issue, because it's not just Ryan's case. There's going to be a lot more people like Ryan on death row in Louisiana who are stone-cold innocent, and we've got to figure out what went wrong.
Pauline Matthews, what has it been like for you and for your son Ryan over these past years that he has been on death row?
The fact that Ryan has been wrongfully in prison, it has been a big impact on my life. It has changed my life totally, and I haven't touched Ryan in 4 years. And, you know, to sit behind the screen, see my child shackled at the waist, his hands. He had to learn how to eat like that, take his medicine like that when he visits with me. And it's very hard knowing that he's innocent and has to be on death row for some a crime that he did not commit. And he has always said he was innocent. You know, and I feel that he should be free because the conditions he's living under. It's so unfair that a person, a child, would have to go through this. And I can't imagine how Ryan feels, but I know that it's been very hard on me. It's devastated my life because I love Ryan Matthews, and I want to see Ryan Matthews free.
Billy Southern, you're the lawyer for Ryan Matthews and a staff attorney with the Louisiana Crisis Assistance Center. Here he is in Angola prison, where so many thousands of men are incarcerated. What is the schedule of events now? Why hasn't he been freed immediately?
Well, like Peter said, there's a reluctance on the part of the District Attorney Paul Connick of Jefferson Parish, you know, to really see the truth in this case. And, you know, it's not surprising to us because these are the same people who are responsible for seeing that Ryan gets freed. It's the same system that saw that an innocent man was put on death row in the first place. Jefferson Parish District Attorney's Office made news about 2 months ago because during death penalty prosecutions of juveniles, district attorneys were wearing neckties with images of nooses on them. This is the same parish that has a persistent pattern of racism in the selection of jurors. And then in this case, we see what's pretty clear: suppression of evidence, suppression of DNA evidence, suppression of the fact that the key witness against Ryan had pending charges against her in Jefferson Parish, pending felony charges that were, you know, clearly weighing on her mind when she was testifying against Ryan. So I think that what the schedule. There is no fixed schedule. You know, Ryan could sit exactly where he is on death row for years unless we really kind of pressure the powers that be to do the right thing. And I think that means, sending letters to Paul Connick, the district attorney of Jefferson Parish, and you know, trying to pressure these people to act, because every day that Ryan sits in jail is a total travesty, a total injustice.
As the New York Times describes it, on April 7th, 1997, a masked gunman shot Tommy Van Hoos to death in the store he owned in Bridge City, Louisiana, a little riverside place in the shadow of the Huey P. Long Bridge. 8 months later, half mile away, a killer slashed the throat of Chandra Conley. Her 5-year-old son found her dead in a pool of blood. The state of Louisiana tried and convicted Ryan Matthews in the first killing, which took place when he was 17. Rondell Love, a convicted drug dealer, was found guilty in the second. Both men went to the prison farm in Angola. Both cases were closed. Now you've got the DNA case. Peter Neufeld, how does this case compare to other DNA tests that you have done?
Oh, no, the DNA evidence is pretty impeccable here. But you just raised a very interesting point, Amy, which is that, you know, here, because of this incredible tunnel vision on the part of the cops in Jefferson Parish, I mean, think about it. The eyewitness says the assailant rips the ski mask from his face after the shooting, throws it down on the street, and then the eyewitness picks it up. They do DNA testing on that ski mask on the saliva and skin cells left by the person who was wearing it, you know, in the mouth area. And they get a profile, and the profile doesn't match, Mr. Matthews. What police should do at that point is say, my God, maybe we're going down the wrong direction here. Let's look for other people. Had the police done that in an appropriate and timely fashion, not only would they have avoided putting Brian in prison, but they could have perhaps prevented Randall Love, had they captured him in time, from committing another homicide sometime later, the one that actually put him in prison. They would have prevented that crime. And you know what that sounds, what that's reminiscent of? Something that happened here in New York City in the Central Park jogger case, where there was a fellow named Reyes who had committed almost an identical crime a few days before the Central Park jogger case. He was identified by a police officer. If the police had pursued that matter, they would have prevented the Central Park jogger case from happening. More importantly, they would have prevented other murders from happening. Because every time the police get the wrong guy in prison, the real bad guy continues to commit crimes out there. So it's a lose-lose situation.
Finally, Pauline Matthews, your hopes for the future right now and for your son, Ryan Matthews?
I hope that I can feel and touch Ryan, and I hope that the DA act quickly to get this information in court and free Ryan Matthews, because I want him free. I want to hug and kiss Ryan Matthews, and I want my child home.
If people want to get more information on the case, you can go on the web to reprieve.org. You can go to our website for contact information at democracynow.org. And a very special thanks to Emily Kunstler and to Julia Phillips, who provided the recordings today of Clive Stafford Smith from the press conference, and most importantly, James Harrison, the exclusive video that Emily did of James Harrison in jail right now, who overheard the jailhouse confession of Rondell Love. I want to thank all the people who have just joined us, Pauline Matthews, mother of Ryan Matthews, Billy Southern, the lawyer for Ryan Matthews, Peter Neufeld of the Innocence Project here in New York, and Julia and Emily. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move directly to Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of Shiite Muslims have converged on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala and are demanding U.S. troops get out of Iraq. The numbers could surpass 1 million this week as the pilgrimage reaches its climax. According to a front-page report in today's Washington Post, Bush administration officials say they underestimated the organizational strength of the Shiites. They're concerned the Shiites could establish a fundamentalist Islamic anti-American government in Iraq and are unprepared to prevent it. A meeting of generals and admirals at the Pentagon on Monday turned into a spontaneous teach-in on Iraq Shiites and the U.S. strategy for containing Islamic fundamentalism in Iraq. We're going to go first to Al Jazeera correspondent Yusuf Al-Shuli, who is reporting right now from Karbala. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Yusuf.
Thank you.
Can you describe the scene in Karbala right now?
Well, actually, more than 2 million of people are gathering in the city in order to practice some religious behaviors and political behaviors as well. Well, I can call these demonstrations as the spring of Karbala or the spring of Shi'at in the world, because it is for the first time the Shi'at in Iraq are practicing their rights or religious rights in such a way and such behavior and in obvious since 3 decades. Although this practice is being done while Iraq is passing through a difficult social and economic situation as a result of the war. The people here are representing most of the Iraqi towns and villages in south and even in north Iraq. They are carrying their pamphlets and speaking and expressing their themselves, and they want, as they said, they want independence, they want their freedom, they want the foreign troops to go out of Iraq. And also they want a new government, national unity, government that represents the people of Iraq to govern the country. They also expressing their religious behaviors or religious beliefs and their political motivations, and they want to live in dignity, in peace, and to express themselves and to have their own human rights be saved. And also they are demanding that the prisoners to be freed. They are insisting that hundreds of thousands, as they say, of prisoners are still in jails since and they are asking the American troops to help them free those prisoners who are still in jails from the British government. Okay?
Yes, we're speaking with Yusuf Al-Shuli, reporting from Karbala. I wanted to ask your response to a Washington Post piece today that says Bush administration officials say they underestimated the organizational strength of the Shiites and that they're concerned that they could establish a fundamentalist Islamic anti-American government in Iraq and are unprepared to prevent it. Your response, Yusuf Al-Shuli.
Well, actually, this demonstration and this gathering can be considered as a message to the United States that the Shiites are strong and they are they can do if they want to do. Until now, I have heard from them that they want, by peaceful means, the American troops to go out. They are not resorting to other means right now. They said we are thankful for the Americans that they have liberated us from the previous government, but now we want them to go out. Well, actually, what you have asked about maybe have some right aspects for the questions, but what I've heard and seen from the Iraqi people, they now want to live in peace. They don't want wars. They said we have witnessed three wars during the past 3 decades, and that's enough. We are fed up, and we want to live in dignity, want to live in peace. Actually, the Shia religious group, what they call it here, the Hausa, are strong enough. And from 3 days, for the past 3 days in Karbala, I think that the Hausa have succeeded in organizing this gathering in such a way that there is no disturbances. Even trouble that someone or somebody speculate it will occur during this ceremony. But since they have succeeded in this gathering, I think they have the capability or the capacity to succeed in the coming exercises if that can happen. Okay?
Yusuf Al-Shuli, last question. The reports that U.S. troops detained and later released a senior Shiite Muslim cleric, Ayatollah Mohammad Taqi Mudaresi, the leader of an Iraqi exile group, after he crossed the border from Iran to attend the pilgrimage in Karbala.
Well, I have heard from unconfirmed reports that Mujahideen Khalq have arrested him and released them after crossing the border from Iran to Iraq. I don't know whether the Americans or the other groups have arrested him, but actually I have received a pamphlet from his office. In that pamphlet, he is insisting on the religious aspects of this event, of this ceremony. That pamphlet have not mentioned any political or current situation in Iraq. And that's what I have known about him. And I've asked some senior officials from religious parties here, and nobody has any information about this arrest. But the people say he was arrested and he was released later on the crossing point between Iran and Iraq.
Do people want a fundamentalist, Islamic, anti-American government in Iraq?
Well, the people want to govern themselves through elected government that represent the majority, as they say here in Karbala. The majority, according to them, is a Shia. They don't want what they call terrorists or any other organizations. They want to live in peace, freedom, dignity, and they can utilize their wealth, the Iraqi wealth, they don't mind that others can share them in doing this, but they have to be, the first say is their say, not the others. So they want the foreigners to go out from them peacefully. They are thankful for them, but enough, they want independence, and that's what they are saying.
Yusuf Al-Shuli, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Yusuf Al-Shuli is the Al Jazeera correspondent speaking to us from southern Iraq in Karbala. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about the significance of the Shia pilgrimage and the conflict that is going on in Iraq right now. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The front page piece of The Washington Post by Glenn Kessler and Dana Priest, U.S. planners surprised by strength of Iraqi Shiites. As Iraqi Shiite demands for a dominant role in Iraq's future mount, Bush administration officials say they underestimated the Shiites' organizational strength and are unprepared to prevent the rise of an anti-American Islamic fundamentalist government in the country. As the administration plotted to overthrow Hussein's government, U.S. officials said this week it failed to fully appreciate the force of Shiite aspirations and is now concerned that those sentiments could coalesce into a fundamentalist government. Some administration officials were dazzled by Ahmed Chalabi, the prominent Iraqi exile who is a Shiite and an advocate of a secular democracy. Others were more focused on the overriding goal of defeating Hussein and paid little attention to the dynamics of religion and politics in the region. We're going to continue to talk about this issue right now, continue to talk about the issue of both the Shiites in relation to the U.S. government and the troops that are there, as well as the Shiites in relation to the Sunnis. We're joined by Asad Abu Khalil, who is a professor of political science at California State University, Stanislaus, and author of Bin Laden, Islam and America's New War on Terrorism. Your comment on this?
Well, I think this is a very important development, and I think the level of ignorance on the part of U.S. policymakers can never be underestimated. And I read this piece in the Washington Post. What I find very interesting is that how could people plan a war against a country and know so little, if anything, about what's going on? And it's very true what they said in the article about the extent to which they wanted to believe everything that this embezzler, Ahmed Chalabi, the head of the so-called Iraqi National Congress, they believed what he said about Iraq and what he told them about Iraqi public opinion without noticing that he has never been there in 45 years and that he has absolutely no popular base in that country. And what Yusuf Shuli, he's a great reporter. I watch him all the time on Al Jazeera. But I was reading before I came with you on Al Jazeera website about some of the slogans that were being chanted. And it's very interesting. Most of them emphasize that the people who speak on their own behalf are the clerical leadership of Najaf, the highly important religious site inside Iraq. And many of the chants are, in fact, against Israel and the United States. Some of them are indistinguishable from the slogans we hear in Iran: death to Israel, death to the United States. And also, there were some slogans against Ahmad Shalabi himself. I can guarantee you, the self-designated leader of Iraq that the United States was hoping to be, the Hamid Karzai of the new republic that the United States was going to establish in Iraq, will not dare step foot in any of those areas where the majority of Iraqis live. So this is something about the future, and don't be surprised if years from now, when we have a new Islamic Republic in Iraq that will be aligned with Iran, that some people among the policymakers feel suddenly nostalgic to the rule of Saddam Hussein. They absolutely have no idea what they were going into, and when many of us in the anti-war movement and most Middle East academics I know have been opposed to this war, and even with the intoxication with the so-called quick military victory that they have on their hand, they did not have any estimation of the long-term and even shorter-term political repercussions of the country. What Yusuf said about that, at this point, there is kind of an agreement that the resistance to the occupation of the United States is peaceful. For the time being, I think it's true. However, some new groups are sprouting, and some of them with new names are claiming responsibility on behalf of attacks against U.S. troops in the country. So we are into a very long chapter of U.S. involvement with the Iraqi resistance movement. And it is very much, as somebody who lived under Israeli occupation after 1982, Israeli invasion of Lebanon, I'm very much reminded of the kind of cycle that began with that invasion. The victorious army become very intoxicated with victory, and they think they can smash any resistance movement, any voice that they don't like, by military force. And after several years of bloody encounters, they pack and then they leave. I also want to say in this regard that the people in the government, how ignorant they were about what happened. Paul Wolfowitz, one of the key policymakers on Iraq, Deputy Secretary of Defense, and he gave an interview last year in which he said, Iraqi Shiites are different from other people because they are all secular, and he said they also don't have religious sites like Saudi Arabia. I mean, think about this. This guy is considered to be the in-house expert on Islam because he served for 1 year in Indonesia as ambassador, did not know the significance of the holy sites inside Iraq. I mean, even people in South Lebanon, where I come from, the Shiites there have strong orientation towards the south of the country for that reason. And then they decide to have a leader for Iraq, Ahmad Shalabi, who has strong ties to Israel. He's close friends with Nathan Sharansky. We are told he's been to Israel, and he sent a representative, Kanan Makia, to represent him at the last conference of the pro-Israeli lobby in Washington, D.C. And they think Iraqis will not care about all these developments. Well, obviously, they do.
Assad Abu Khalil, professor of political science at California State University, Stanislaus, author of Bin Laden, Islam, and America's New War on Terrorism. As we end today's program with Professor Edward Said, he's a professor of comparative literature at Columbia University. He spoke a few nights ago during a day-long celebration of his work, Orientalism. He is also author of Culture and Imperialism. We're going to play the extended speech tomorrow, but now an excerpt. Professor Edward Said.
What our leaders and their intellectual lackeys seem incapable of understanding is that history cannot be swept clean, like a blackboard, clean so that we might inscribe our own future there and impose our own forms of life for these lesser people to follow. It's quite common to hear high officials in Washington and elsewhere speak of changing the map of the Middle East, as if ancient societies and myriad peoples could be shaken up like so many peanuts in a jar. But this has often happened with the Orient, that semi-mythical construct, which since Napoleon's invasion of Egypt in the late 18th century has been made and remade countless times by power acting through an expedient form of knowledge to assert that this is the Orient's nature and we must deal with it accordingly. In the process, the uncountable sediments of history that include innumerable narratives and a dizzying variety of peoples, languages, experiences, and cultures, all these are swept aside or ignored, relegated to the sand heap, along with the treasures that have been ground into meaningless fragments that were taken out of Baghdad's libraries and museums. My argument is that if history is made by men and women, it can also be unmade and rewritten, always with various silences and elisions, always with shapes imposed and disfigurements tolerated, so that our East, our Orient, becomes ours to possess and direct. I should say again, as I do many times in the book, that I have no real Orient to argue for. I do, however, have a very high regard for the powers and gifts of the peoples of that region to struggle on for their vision of what they are and want to be. There's been so massively and calculatedly aggressive an attack on the contemporary societies of the Arab and Muslim worlds for their backwardness, lack of democracy, and abrogation of humans and women's rights, that we simply forget in the process that such notions as modernity, enlightenment, and democracy are by no means simple and agreed upon concepts that one either does or does not find like Easter eggs in the living room. The breathtaking insouciance of jejune publicists who speak in the name of foreign policy and who have no live notion or any knowledge at all of the language of what real people actually speak has fabricated an arid landscape ready for American power to construct there an ersatz model of free market democracy without even a trace of doubt that such projects don't exist, really, outside of Swift's Academy of Legado. What I do argue also is that there is a difference between knowledge of other peoples and other times that is the result of understanding, compassion, careful study and analysis, as in Auerbach's case, for their own sakes. And on the other hand, there is knowledge, if that's what it is, that is part of an overall campaign of self-affirmation, belligerency, and outright war. There is, after all, a profound difference between the will to understand for purposes of coexistence and humanistic enlargement of horizons, and the will to dominate for the purposes of control and external dominion.
Professor Edward Said, speaking several nights ago at a celebration of his book, Orientalism. Professor Said teaches comparative literature as a university professor at Columbia University. We will be playing the extended speech tomorrow on Democracy Now! For today, special thanks to Joe Friendly. If you'd like to get a video or audio cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Our email address, mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel and Vilka Tsouris. Special thanks to Emily Kunstler and Julia Phillips today. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. Again, if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.